Well, thank you very much and welcome to all of you. We, I think, are going to have a very interesting and stimulating discussion about some very provocative issues and some very timely ones. I won't take a lot of time to introduce our panelists since you probably know them and you have a little blurb in your books that introduces each of them. Steve Friedman is an old friend and an old colleague from Goldman Sachs. He's held senior positions in advising President Bush. He's been actively involved in the business and financial world. He's actively involved in the National Intelligence Council and a great many other things, and one of the very thoughtful people in our country on international economic issues and particularly international financial issues. Gene Sperling's another very old friend. We've worked together for a number of years on a variety of economic and other issues. Gene has served as a senior advisor on economic issues to President Clinton, but his issues and his concerns go well beyond that. He's been actively involved in educational issues. He writes very frequently and very eloquently on a variety of trade and other issues. All of you, I think, can follow what he writes. It's very thoughtful and very much cutting edge about the kind of domestic and international issues we as a country are facing today. So what we thought we would do this morning, is to try to put together a few thoughts for the next president, not so much in terms of specific recommendations, but some general ideas about the challenges the president will face in addressing global economic issues. And in doing that, in saying global economic issues, I'm not only referring to the more traditional global economic issues, but what we can do within our own country to strengthen our competitiveness, to strengthen our ability to deal with global economic challenges, to enable more and more Americans, middle and lower income Americans, many of whom feel that they're not participating in the benefits of globalization or the benefits of change in terms of new technologies and new ideas. Many feel they're left behind. How do we bring them along so that they feel that globalization and global technical change benefits them as well? So what I thought I would do initially is ask each of our two panelists to comment very briefly on the challenges they see for the next president in addressing these global economic issues and related domestic issues, and some of the thoughts they would convey to the next president as to how to deal with those challenges. Then we'll become more specific as we go along, and toward the very end, we'll open this up to questions or comments from the audience. So let me start with Steve and then turn to Gene, and then we'll enter into a discussion amongst us on these matters.
Thanks, Bob. If I were to be briefing the next president-elect, it would be not only about the challenges, but about the interconnection of the politics of dealing with the various challenges. And I would do it with great deference, because whoever it is you're briefing knows a heck of a lot more about politics than you do. That's how they got to be president-elect. But these are not issues that are going to get resolved by purist economic solutions. They're going to get resolved, in my view, only when the fear of the future exceeds the pain of change, and by rough political compromises. But all is not gloomy, and before I got to the challenges, I would tell the president-elect that right now the U.S. and the world economy are doing very well. As a matter of fact, we're living in an unprecedented period. People have called it the third industrial revolution. Think about it. Give or take a third of the world's population, just in China and India, are coming dramatically into the market economy. Hundreds of millions of people are being lifted out of poverty into much happier living circumstances. With that goes the fact that the equilibrium point in the world economy is starting to move eastward. Economists have predicted that the period of 2003 to 2008 maybe the greatest global economic growth since any kind of credible data have been collected. Within the U.S. itself, if you looked at the principal items that should be on the president-elect's economic dashboard. One of them would be, what's the unemployment level? Well, it's give or take 4.5% right now. What's the inflation rate? Well, the Fed has to worry about this and worry about that, but it's give or take in and around 2%. It's contained. You all, I think this audience mostly is old enough to remember the famous misery index, where you combine those two. Well, the misery index is looking awful well, awfully good. Now, I'd add a third item to the dashboard, which is crucial, is the rate of growth. It's been a little bit sluggish recently, but the consensus forecast is for it to get back close to the speed limit for the economy, the speed limit being the rate at which the economy can grow without triggering inflation. Stock markets, to the extent that it's a predictor, is doing fine. So I'd say that your economy is doing well at this point, but, and you all know that you really want to pay a lot of attention to the part of the sentence that comes after the but. And the part that comes after the but is that, sir or madam, there are some major, major challenges that you're going to be facing during your administration. And some of these challenges are ones that are longer term. Some of them are ones that are imminent or right here, right now. Some of them are challenges that they're challenges, but in some ways I'm more worried about the political cures that will be attempted than I am about the malady itself. Without any prioritization or trying to be complete about them, I'd list these. The U.S., the United States oil dependency, which is one which a major spike in oil prices for whatever reason, dramatic incident in the Straits of Hormuz, could throw our economy into a tailspin. We are really, in many ways, hostage to some of the least dependable parts of the world. Threats to trade liberalization. A huge amount of wealth has been generated for American citizens by the free trade surge throughout the world in recent decades. It is clear that in the U.S. and elsewhere, this is under threats, not only populist threats in the United States, but threats in China, of all places, beneficiary that they are to, if you read in today's paper, threats to foreign direct investment there. It's an interesting thing. In times of war, countries try to block their adversaries' trade. That's a crippling weapon in a military situation. Here you have nations, because of their own internal political stresses, threatening to block their free trade themselves. I mean, it makes me think of that scene in Blazing Saddles where the guy points a gun at his head and stop or I'll shoot. I mean, we're risking grave danger to ourselves. Another challenge I'd tell Mr. or Madam President-elect is the demographic time bomb. This is one that's certain. It's actuarial. As the population grows older, the baby boomers grow older, we've done something quite immoral. We've overpromised. We've promised benefits, retirement benefits and health benefits that we can't pay without either dramatic increases in taxes, dramatic borrowing, or we're going to have to cut them. And we haven't really made that clear to the public. And to some extent, the public doesn't want to hear it. The dollar and the dollar, the risk to the dollar from the twin deficits, the budget deficit and the trade deficit. Will we have a soft landing or will we have something precipitous? That's something that I think any president has to be thinking about, if not daily, every week throughout his or her term. Risks in terms of overregulation. You know, I talked about how our economy is now doing very well. It is a golden goose. There is no other economy, major economy in the world, that you would trade the U.S. economy for with all our warts. We do have the capacity to inflict harm on ourselves and to kill that golden goose. environmental issues and how they're dealt with, risks to financial stability in a world that has priced risk at an extremely optimistic basis, wealth disparities, which has gotten growing attention. I might point out this is an issue that's been going on, the disparity in wealth between our richest and our poorest, or even in the upper deciles, been going on for decades, and it's not just a U.S. issue. In some ways, this is one where I'm more worried about some of the potential cures than the disease. And I would say the wild card for any economist, a cadre of which I'm not one, is the unpredictability of terrorist incidents or pandemics. And last, I would say to the president, the challenge is to maintain the optimistic, entrepreneurial, risk-taking flavor which has made the U.S. economy so strong. And that's where I'd say he or she has got to take a Hippocratic oath. Bob.
Thank you, Steve. Gene.
Thank you. The first thing I would tell the next president of the United States is that the issue of whether expanded globalization and expanded use of information technology is going to be seen as strengthening or hollowing out the middle class is going to be the number one economic paradigm which will shape economic policy over the next decade. And I think that the goal for that next president, and this will be difficult, is to have an equal focus on having a rising tide and ensuring that it's lifting all boats. And it will be difficult because, as Steve is somewhat suggesting, but I'll have a somewhat different tune, is that neither side of the political debate really, I think, wants to hear both messages enough. So what Steve was mentioning is often the message, I think, our side, Democratic progressive side, doesn't hear enough, which is that the things that Steve said about not killing the golden goose, globalization is inevitable. It cannot be slowed down or shut down. And you have to deal with it. America has to engage. And what we do know is that when it comes to innovation, entrepreneurship, not insulating ourselves from competition, being flexible in terms of dealing with economic change, these are the things that leads to America being the most productive country, and I think still the envy of the world economically. And many of the threats that we see from globalization will become opportunities in longer periods of time. If India keeps growing at 8% a year, their per capita income will quadruple by 2025. There will be, unquestionably, in the next 15, 20 years, hundreds and hundreds of millions of new middle-class consumers around the world. If you ask who is going to be best positioned to meet those needs, to benefit from that, keeping America open, flexible, innovative, entrepreneurial is incredibly important to allowing us to have that rising tide, that growth that allows us to have more room to come in. Now, there's a lot of people on the progressive side who don't necessarily want to hear that message, but I will say there's too many people who don't want to hear the other side as well. And the other side is you cannot assume right now in the global economy that a rising tide is automatically going to lift all boats. And I think those who make that assumption, who decide that you can just look at your GDP and your corporate profit level and say whether the economy is working with typical people, for typical Americans or around the world, are going to be misguided. We are not for growth for the sake of growth. We're not for growth because our founders wanted us to have high GDP. We were a country that was based on the idea that we could have a growing and inclusive middle class. We don't care about growth if it all goes to a royal family or to 1%. The measure of growth in our economy, the measure of growth for our values is it the type of growth that is leading to a broader and more inclusive middle class? And let me say that if you look at the last 10 or 11 years, there are reasons to be concerned. You know, yes, some of the good news coincided with when we and President Clinton were there, but I'll be the first to say these issues are broader than any particular president. But what you saw in the end, the last 6-7 years of the 90s, was you saw productivity growth go up 15-16%, and real median wages for families also go up 15-16%. That was an extremely pretty picture for those of us who just wanted to believe that a stronger, more open global economy would necessarily work for everyone. That has turned around in the last 5 years, and we cannot deny that, nor can we say it's just, you know, who has the best tax or fiscal policy. The fact is that productivity growth has actually been a bit stronger over the last 5 or 6 years, up maybe 16%, and yet real median family income is actually down 2%. And the inequality that we're seeing is a bit of a different type of inequality. It's not so much the inequality between the top and the bottom. It is increasingly the inequality between the very top and the middle. And that is what people refer to as a polarization or the fears of hollowing out. And, you know, let's just be honest. It makes a bit of economic logic. The gains from globalization and technology highly reward many of the people sitting here who are at the top of the skill level, the very top. And you know what? It doesn't hurt as much some of the people who do stuff that's not affected by globalization. But the people more in the middle are increasingly seeing finding that increased globalization technology, instead of being rewarded, leads to greater labor market competition from around the world. It is good news that we had some of the highest corporate profits shares in our history in the last few years. But 50% of that was because of historically low wage growth. And we have to kind of acknowledge that if we want an economy that works, that this president has to not kill the golden goose, but focus on the fact that the Americans who are feeling a bit of anxiety, who are worried they're taking fears of falling, are not misled or misguided or somehow responding to demagoguery. They have real, live, legitimate concerns that that the next president needs to focus on. Now, let me give three or four specific kind of broader areas that I think the next president has to focus on. Number one, a broader, more universal safety net is a necessary but not a sufficient condition. You know, yes, we do less to help people in between jobs than any country in the world. We spend 1/6 per GDP what most European countries do. We spend half of what even the UK does. Now, we don't want to make the mistakes they've made. We don't want to do things that lock people in. But we could have, but you know, any American can pretty much plop into any city in the United States right now and know how to rent a movie, how to order a pizza, where to go to an all-night grocer. But if somebody with a high school degree loses their job and fears for their family's security, I bet there's not 2,000 people who know exactly what benefits are available to them, where they would go, what departments. If you're going to do something about that anxiety, you need to have a broader, simpler, universal system. Benefits shouldn't be tied to how you lose your jobs. So things like wage insurance, health insurance, these type of things, having a broader safety net, are extremely important. Now, the problem is that a lot of people would like to end the discussion there. They'd like to say, great, economy's working great, we'll just do a little more for the so-called losers, and, you know, we're done. But, you know, I've got to tell you, and I wouldn't, as Steve said, I wouldn't have to tell the next president there, they would know this. That can't be your sole message. That is, I'll tell you what workers call that message. They call it burial insurance. We're going to give you better burial insurance. I like to say that adjustment policy is the prenup of public policy. It's what we're going to do for you after something bad happens to your life. Well, you know what? If someone comes to me and says, Gene, great news. You know, your employer's offering you a wonderful counseling package once your wife leaves you for your best friend. I don't go, gee, that's great. I go, well, but how do I keep my wife from leaving me for my best friend? So when you come and a politician, a president says, I've got great news, I've got ways of helping you after you lose the job you care so deeply about, that's not a particularly satisfactory message. Now, here is where Steve's concern about the Hippocratic Oath becomes very important, because the thing that I find the public most wants is they would like their leaders to tell them either how they're going to protect their current job or where the new middle class jobs are coming from. And the unfortunate thing is, What people, I think, most want is probably what government is the worst at. Protection does not work in the long run. And industrial policy, picking winners, you know, we all know the story, you know, the graduate where, you know, the guy comes up and goes, plastics. You know, in 1993, the Bureau of Labor Statistics projected that being a travel agent would be one of the top 10 growing jobs in the United States because they were looking at the larger number of higher wealth retirees, which made a lot of sense. They just missed that little thing, the internet. And so, you know, travel agents, by the way, have gone down 43%, not a growth industry at the moment. So we're not great at kind of picking the winners. But here's the question. If the next president has nothing to say, if they have no good answers on where the new middle class jobs are coming from, then I fear it will get filled in with the bad solutions, the industrial policy, the New Deal jobs, the protectionism. We need to focus a little more on where we can do more on jobs that's smart. A radical investment in energy innovation across this country would be good for the things Steve's talking to. It would be pro-jobs. The fact that we haven't had a dollar in real increases in NIH funding when we're the last 3 years, when we're competing like crazy for the research jobs of the future, makes no sense. So to the president, they need a broad safety net, but they need to have a story on jobs. Second thing I would tell them is universal health care that brings down costs is not just a good idea, it's not just a twofer, it's a threefer or a fourfer. Number one, a lot of the anxiety that people feel about losing their jobs is the fact that in our country, losing your job means losing your health care. That means an enormous number of Americans are one job loss and one illness away from financial devastation. Universal health care would deal a lot with some of the globalization issues. Second, we spend about, you know, the story, the line that gets out there now is that a lot of companies say we spend more on the health care for our worker than we spend for the salary of somebody in India or China. The high cost, the 80% increase in premiums for workers is unquestionably becoming a disincentive to permanent job location. So universal health care that brought down health care would also be a twofer, and that would also help, I think, encourage job creation. Third, on fiscal policy, the notion that you're somehow going to have a commission that's going to somehow lower Medicare and Medicaid costs, which are the big growth, without dealing with overall health care costs is unrealistic. We're not going to have something where health care costs go up like this, and then you have Medicare and Medicaid become second-rate poor people's health care. If we're going to do something about those programs, we've got to bring the costs down. So that's at least a threefer. If a fourfer is just it's a national disgrace that we have 45 million people who go to bed every night without health care. And then my last message would be on education. And here I think the next president has to talk straight with the American people. And here's my straight talk message, which is a difficult one for a politician to say. We are entering a period where education has simultaneously never been less of a sure thing and never been more important. It is less of a sure thing because you cannot say honestly that if your kid graduates from a decent four-year public school, that they are somehow protected that much from the global economy. You have to look at the software engineers, the radiologists. The competition we're going to face is strong. And that shakes up a lot of people who organize their whole life around the idea of their kid going to college or them going to college. Now, a lot of people want to hear that and say, aha, you see, education doesn't protect you that much. But the other message is, it is less of a sure thing, but it still increases your odds the most that you will successfully survive or do well in the global economy. Those jobs, those service jobs that compete with India and China are still going to be higher paying jobs. You still want to be in those sectors. So yes, education has never been more important, and it's never been less of a sure thing. And we all know that with our own kids. We know it's less of a sure thing, but we want our kids to do as well as possible. And the truth is, we're going to get to a phase where a postgraduate degree is going to be the new college degree in terms of what you have to do. And that creates a lot of anxiety. And my last thing, come back on that, is I spend a lot of my life working on education in developing countries. That's the project I do at the Council on Foreign Relations. And I want to say, what an incredibly important thing would be if the United States led a global effort to give every child, every girl, every boy, universal basic education. And a lot of the message you hear from political leaders is we should do that so that they don't go into dangerous madrasas, then fundamentalist madrasas that will lead to bombing us. And that is one reason to do universal education. But let me tell you something. You don't win hearts and minds by telling people that you only care about their kid to the degree that they don't grow up and bomb your kid. You win hearts and minds by the United States showing people that we care about all children because they're all God's children, and that we care about how globalization operates in their country, that we have, that our morals and values want them to have both a rising tide that lifts all boats as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Let me just build on something Gene said about education. First, let me go back to the disparity in incomes. It's undeniably a fact. It's undeniably a problem. It's widespread. As I said earlier, it's not just in the United States. It's broader. It's now perceived as a problem in, of all places, China. One of the tricky things about it is economists really aren't sure of all the causes at this point. It's very clear that, or that they're not sure of calibrating how much of the various candidates' causes have led to the results. They're pretty clear that what Gene talked about, the globalization is a factor, but the things I read say that it's probably a minority part of the factor. In the United States, trade is not that huge a part of our GDP. What seems to be a much, much bigger factor is the increasing technological, the information revolution that more and more calls for rarefied skill sets and more builds in discrimination based on people's education levels. We have inflicted great wounds on ourselves in the education area. At the college level, our colleges are by and large considered the leaders in the world, but we have this dramatic paucity. Somehow there's been a market failure in that we have not attracted enough kids into science and to engineering. We're enormously dependent on immigrants for that. And by the way, if we can't get them in here and we can't get the visas for them and we can't get them to stay, we are shortchanging ourselves on the upper end of the technology thing, which will create those good jobs. But that's not even our biggest problem. Overwhelmingly, our biggest problem in the educational front is K through 12. These countries, other countries in the world that we may be talking about universal education, well, frankly, an awful lot of them are kicking our butts in terms of the quality of the education they're giving our kids. In the minority committees, something like 50% of the African American kids that are in the ninth grade are not going to graduate. I don't think the graduation levels are a lot higher for Hispanic kids, and the education levels are just disappointing. We just do badly on these objective international tests. What are the reasons for this? Well, Gene has lived in this area, and I'm just a newspaper reader, but the thing that I find remarkable is that America's parents are not outraged by this. I mean, if you look at your kids and they're wherever they are, 23rd in the world in math skills behind Latvia, and you know your kid is going to be competing with kids in other countries, I know American parents would be outraged if the football team at their kid's high school practiced for as few minutes a day as their kids are actually doing in their homework assignments. The kid in Korea goes to school, packs two lunches, one of them for the lunch, and the other for late afternoon when he's doing the special sessions. And this is something that if I were advising the president, I would say that you're not going to get major change until you have in this area, until you have a wave of public indignation about the fact that we're tying one arm behind our back. At that point, you can start to talk about fixes, whether it's more school choice or competition or pay for performance, et cetera, things that I don't pretend any expertise on. But we do have a problem, and we do have a remarkable shortfall in the public ire about this problem.
Can I just to,
On the education, let me just add a couple of things. It was at the Aspen Institute that David Elwood, who's now the dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard, first produced a study that talked about the fact of how little labor growth we would have, but that within that labor growth, the composition of that labor market would be become more African-American and more Hispanic. So we are at a point right now where I believe our values of wanting an inclusive society where we're reaching out to the youngest and most disadvantaged minority young people and our economic common sense are merging together. I totally understand the argument and I support it that we should be allowing the top scientists and engineers around the world to be here and that adds to our growth. I don't necessarily think that's a great long-term strategy, though. I mean, I think our long-term strategy should be to have more of the young people from minority and Hispanic communities aspiring to fill those spots and seeing those wage gains go to leading to a more equitable society and more of the returns coming here. But to do that, there's one point I have to say. Kids drop out of college in fifth grade. They drop out of college in fifth or sixth grade. And we can't focus everything we do on just the hours at work, of studying or the standards. What affects most of the people here was that you had role models, you had inspiration, you had aspirational goals. We've got to reach out to people at younger ages in ways that go beyond just what happens in the classroom, but through the other things they do, through the mentors, through the connecting them with colleges at early ages, and getting people to aspire early. High school reform is incredibly important, but high school is often too late. That's one thing. The second thing I wanted to say is that we've focused quite a bit on getting to college. As we all know more, completing college is another issue. And again, you need a lot of intensity for particularly disadvantaged kids as they enter college and in their first year. That will affect a lot whether we get the college completion rates, which will affect a lot who goes on to graduate school and who actually does well in the global economy. And the third thing is the area where we don't spend as much time. And so let me throw this on as an issue for next year, which is what type of education? I have one expression in life that Tom Friedman quotes, so it's clearly the smartest thing I've ever said, since he's the best quote, he's the best phraser I've ever seen. But what it is was, I was saying, when you're trying to ask what your kid needs right now, you're a little bit like somebody training for the Olympics, but you don't know what sport you're going to be in. So if you're training for the Olympics and you don't know what sport you're going to be in, you've got to kind of figure out a kind of a range of kind of athletic skills that will be generally applicable to the unknown. And we've got to try to figure out what are the kind of skills, the learning to learn skills, as Tom says, and other skills that allow people to do well. Is it going to be, I think it may be the ability to kind of work in international teams while having a specialization. We don't spend enough time asking ourselves what type of education do we need in a world where we don't actually know what's going to be most pressing for our fifth graders when they're 25.
Well, thanks. I think we've had some very thoughtful points made about particularly the underlying issues that have to be addressed in this country in order to strengthen our competitiveness and strengthen our role in the world and enable us to be more resilient in the face of these global challenges. Let me just throw out a few specific questions now. First, the issue of trade. This is an issue that both of you have commented on. There seems to be, not only in the United States, but also in other countries, a sort of a populist, quasi-nationalist reaction to globalization. And we've seen it in part in the failure of the current round of trade negotiations, in part in this country in very severe reactions to some of the potential trade agreements that the United States has signed or is contemplating signing, although two agreements did go through very recently through the House. But generally, there's almost an anti-globalization pushback, and yet the new president is going to be faced with the need to address global trade issues, bilateral, regional, multilateral. And of course, the president now does not have what's called fast-track authority or trade promotion authority. Let's suppose the president comes to you, Gene, and says, all right, what should I do about global trade negotiations? Should I wait until we've been able to address some of these domestic issues and done better on them? Should I take some initiatives? How do I deal, for instance, with the growing competitive challenge of China, which is an issue in itself as well as a major problem in the global economy? What two or three points would you convey to the president as to how to deal with that issue? Because he or she's going to have to face that very early on.
Right. And a lot of people are dealing right now. There is no question that trade is first of all, let me just be honest. Seattle, the trade protests that happened in Seattle, they happened in 1999 was probably one of the best economic years of the century. I mean, it was booming jobs, booming wages, et cetera. So that's just to say that this anxiety has been out there for a while. It is growing, and it is becoming more difficult. And unfortunately, what's happening for more political people is that for more, particularly Democrats, but increasingly for Republicans from trade-impacted areas, is that politically this has virtually no upsides for them. It's a way to get a good editorial in the New York Times or Washington Post, but it's not particularly good at home. I think what the thing I'd argue against is that some people wanted to say, let's do a strategic pause. And the reason I think that's a very bad idea is because I think the signal that sends to the world is America's on the sidelines. And I think if progressives do that, they'll exacerbate. You know, I think President Bush has sent a lot of bad signals on kind of working in multilateral ways. And if progressives then come in and kind of become anti-WTO, then they kind of add to that by taking the one area where President Bush has been very multilateral in the WTO and moving against it. So I think we shouldn't look like we're on the sidelines. That said, so I would tell the next president, you know, try to work together, try to forge those consensus together that I think you started to see in the Panama and Peru. And that really is going to mean bringing sides to the table, making, you know, people do things they don't always support or not for their preference, labor standards for some, being for the trade agreements, but try to build that consensus. I wouldn't do a strategic pause. I wouldn't do a pause, but I do think you have to rebuild confidence. You can't just add a few thousand training adjustment assistants. If I had a priority for the next president, I would say, and I'll be honest, saying this particularly to a progressive president who would have to so much take on their own constituents so often to get this done, as President Clinton had to do, I would focus my energy on the Doha round. Because economists, most people understand that multilateral trade agreements is the best thing for global economic growth. And so if you've got to use a limited amount of political capital, do it on the thing that has the best global ramifications, and then at the same time, show through universal education, show through trying to help prevent the worst labor abuses around the world, that and through what you do at home, that you do care about not just a rising tide, but whether it's lifting all boats.
Steve, can you comment on that? And particularly, you made a very interesting point in your earlier presentation about this reaction or negative reaction to certain kinds of foreign investment, and we're seeing that. We've seen a little bit of this with respect to the attempted Chinese purchase of an American oil company, with respect to the Dubai ports issue. But now we're seeing more and more countries with more and more privately held wealth and more governmentally held wealth. Some of them are establishing these sovereign wealth funds, taking foreign exchange out of their foreign exchange reserves and putting it into funds that are going to buy various kinds of equities and other properties. Already we've seen that with Blackstone. And yet we're beginning to see a reaction in this country to the fact that there might be these potentially large foreign takeovers with all the money that they've accumulated, not just bonds, but investment in strategic equity or not such strategic equity. How would you address that kind of issue and the broader issue of what kind of recommendations you'd give the president on how to move forward on trade?
Well, you know, I would say about trade, for almost the last 200 years, if it was one topic that virtually all mainstream economists, whether they were liberal or conservative, one topic that they agreed upon, it is the overwhelming value of free trade for an economy and for the people in the economy. And I'd say if there's one thing that the economics profession has failed on miserably over the last 200 years, it's been educating workers and business people of the virtues of that precept. They just can't seem to get it through most of the populace's value system. Adam Smith said, I think it was in 1775, that it was unlikely that you got, I can't quote him, his prose is marvelous, but paraphrasing, it was unlikely to get two businessmen together, or a group of them, that they would not try to conspire against the public good. In other words, they would start thinking of how they could bar imports which would threaten their own production, their own monopoly systems. I look on an awful lot of the discussion about, I'm for free trade, but it's got to be fair trade, and I look on that as disguised forms of protectionism. I really do not believe that a lot of, there is a definite angst and there's a real underlying reason for the angst, but I think an awful lot of it is people, whether it's business or labor, looking to really protect their own particular turf. And there's a real reason for that. The real reason is that even the economists who are most devoutly for free trade have to acknowledge that, yes, it has this benefits to the economy as a whole and to the populace as a whole, but it is very, very, it can be very, very injurious to particular sectors that are on the losing end of things, just as technology is. The Luddites were Luddites, but they weren't wrong. If you were an artisan in 19th century England and technology was going to come in with spinning machines and things that were going to, yes, it was going to do you out of your high-quality job, but smashing the machines wasn't necessarily good for the whole economy. I think when you take this down to the human level and you if you walk through a Walmart's and you see families there that are typically living paycheck to paycheck. They, in many cases, do not have bank accounts. They've never heard of 401ks. Their money is keeping an envelope. And by the way, at the end of the month, when that envelope is thinner, they're less likely to purchase more. Well, if that family's paycheck is buying 12% more of goods because of free trade, that's a very, very real human benefit. Now, I think that the issues Bob talked about, the Dubai ports and Chinese wanting to buy control of one of our oil companies, I take the national security aspects very seriously. We have a process called the CFIUS process where the different agencies of the U.S. government, including the national security ones and the economic ones, vet these acquisitions very carefully. We really don't want certain countries to have access here which could threaten security. Having said that, I thought the two issues Bob talked about were national embarrassments. I looked at the French, and when the French, when Jacques Chirac, who I rarely quote favorably, decided that it was a matter of strategic importance to the French government to protect this particular yogurt company from a foreign takeover, I thought that was the height of ludicrousness, and I hated to see the United States compete with him in that kind of internal demagoguery. But it is an evidence of the sensitivity of the times, and I would urge the president to be very, very careful on the issues that have bona fide national security issues, but really to try very hard to keep this foreign direct investment flow going. We are winners in that area. Once again, it's the Blazing Saddles moment. The United States has enormous advantages over other countries in terms of the flexibility of our capital, in terms of our ability to extract good returns from investments. In the services sector, the sectors that will be most cut off if you have de facto embargoes on foreign direct investments are ones where we are enormously successful. So I think that would be a dreadful predicament for us to get into. I would say one more thing about the Chinese. To me, the right place to focus on putting pressure on the Chinese is not where the Schumer and Lindsey Graham bill is. The notion of putting this giant tariff on them, we are in a relatively precarious situation with respect to our dollar. We have this enormous trade deficit. We have papered the world with dollars. Happily, as long as our economy is working very well and the golden goose is turning out those eggs, people want to reinvest here. Over the long term, it seems to me, as just one observer, that, as Herbert Stein said years ago, that which is unsustainable tends not to be sustained. A trade deficit as high as we have will have to be changed, and that will happen by the dollar going down. That'll be okay if that's a gradual thing. It'll be a bloody disaster if it's a downward sharp spike. We really, really don't need a trade war. Every week, any president of the United States should be thinking, how do I avoid that? Having said that, there are areas where we bona fide should be putting intense pressure on the Chinese because some of their trade practices are very, very unfair. Well, why don't we focus on their theft of intellectual property, which is totally indefensible, totally indefensible. If you have a society which basically thinks knocking off U.S. intellectual property is a terrific way for entrepreneurs to make a living, that's something where we're totally within our WTO rights and we're protecting a wellspring of U.S. prosperity, which is intellectual property. If the Chinese decide to knock off the Wrigley chewing gum and they have same gum that they've reverse engineered, and then the same wrapper, and then to add insult to injury is delivered in a truck with the same logo, somehow we ought to be able to find a way to make an acceptable WTO case out of things like that.
I'll ask one more question, then I'll turn it over to the audience. Steve, one of the points you mentioned in your initial presentation focused on the energy issue, the strategic elements of the energy issue. One of the concerns I think many of us have as we look out over the next presidency, the next 4 years or 8 years, is that so many imbalances are being built up that are going to have to be worked down or at least managed. You mentioned one of them yourself, which is this current account imbalance and growing dependence in terms of foreign capital. You have that. You have the energy imbalance. When President Carter talked about reducing oil dependence being the moral equivalent of war, we were 30% dependent on foreign oil. Now we're 60% dependent. That dependence is building up. The over-promising with respect to Social Security and Medicare, where these imbalances are going to be enormous in the decade ahead. A lot of unmet needs of the military, which we've or Homeland Security, we've spent a lot on the war. A lot of these things that we should be spending money on at home simply have been short shrift as a result of Iraqi war spending. There are a whole number of these things, and energy seems to me to be one of the most important, because if that dependence builds up, first of all, it adversely affects our current account imbalance. Second, it affects this big buildup of foreign debt. Third, it is an enormous strategic problem if, in fact, there were to be a cutoff of oil for whatever reason, problem in the Straits of Hormuz, terrorism in Nigeria, terrorism against a Saudi oil facility, or any number of other things. You've dealt with this in advising the president. What two or three points would you make, first of all, to the president, second, to mobilize American opinion? It's very difficult in this country to get a coherent policy because one group wants one thing, doesn't want what the other group wants, and there's an ability to block but not a real ability to move forward. How do you address these kinds of issues?
Well, first of all, everything you say is it is a frightening issue. Our economy is dependent on this commodity, where to a tremendous extent this comes from some of the most dangerous, most inhospitable to U.S. interests parts of the world. I mean, if you look at the oil supplies in Iraq, Iran, and Venezuela, you have to worry about other places in the Mideast which are subject to terrorism risks. And, you know, this gets to something, not to wax too philosophical. I have great skepticism about the American public's willingness to support painful trade-offs until the headlights of the train are perceived as coming right through the tunnel right at them. I'd ask anyone in this audience to play a mental mind game and try to think of two or three times in the last in this century or the last half of the last one where we have anticipated a problem and enacted on ourselves tough trade-offs before it was absolutely unavoidable that we do it. Well, the U.S. public loves to keep keep thoughts in their head in a bifurcated way. I am very, very anxious to crack down on China because somehow I don't like them. But by the way, I have a God-given right to go to Walmart or Targets and buy stuff really, really inexpensively. Well, we really, really want to economize on oil and deal with global warming, but there's a God-given right to have relatively cheap gasoline at the pump. And the fact is, we're going to have to do some things where we're going to have to either face some difficult trade-offs now, or we're going to have to run the risk of a major, major crisis at some point. And I think for the next president, if I am right, and that the public has a limited willingness to deal with tough trade-offs, and the public has by and large trained its political leaders that getting out there and showing, quote, leadership doesn't pay off if the leadership is asking them to deal with difficult sacrifices, I think I'd tell them, you have to pick your spots very carefully. You're going to have to mobilize public opinion. And on energy, I think, to me at least, it's a no-brainer that we need to be doing more in nuclear. Even I think many of the Greens are coming around to that. I think we have to do more to increase the efficiency of our oil and gas use. You can't talk to economists about this issue without the notion of a tax on gas coming up. You can't talk to a politician without him saying absolutely it's not on the table. So we're going to have to look at other things to be doing there. One of them, for instance, if we have a protectionist tax on the raw materials for ethanol being imported into the country, well, we ought to get rid of that. I mean, are we trying to conserve energy or are we trying to push largesse towards Iowa farmers. And I think we have to be looking seriously at supply of energy from sources outside the Persian Gulf, for instance, U.S. tar sands. And we have to be spending more. We are spending more. We are spending a lot more on alternative sources of energy. For instance, some of the battery and related techniques.
Thanks. Do you want to make a short comment, and then I want to ask the audience for their questions?
Since we're doing advice to the president, what I wanted to comment a little bit on was, is this issue of the fact that you come to these kind of conferences, and there is a certain number of things that you kind of think, you know, there's Steve Friedman. He was President Bush's national economic advisor. I'm Bill Clinton. I was President Clinton's national economic advisor. It feels like we could kind of agree on a certain number of things. You know, what's the matter with Washington? And I think it's worth kind of asking, you know, how you actually lead to things getting done. When I was at the NEC, I always used to, there's a certain type of memo that sometimes somebody would want me to give to the president. It was one where they said, you know, we ought to be just for free trade, it's great for this, or we ought to just raise a dollar gas tax because it'll be good for energy. We ought to just, you know, do this on Social Security. And I always used to call them good luck memos. They were like, Mr. President, here's a really huge issue, and good luck, sir. Good luck. And I think that you know, I say this whenever I talk to younger people going into policy. The two easiest things in the world are to figure out what is the purely best political thing to do and what is the purely pure right policy thing to do. What's actually difficult is to figure out what's the most viable good thing you can do that's viable and how to do it without, you know, doing more harm than good. And I think that what we don't talk about enough or figure out enough is how we provide the political cover for our leaders to do the right thing. I mean, you know, it's easy to say, you know, why don't people show leadership? But a lot of times when people say, why don't you show leadership, what they mean is, why don't you commit political suicide, get a really great New York Times and Washington Post editorial, get praised at the Aspen Ideas Conference, and, you know, have the end of your political career. So, for example, I mean, somebody right now, a candidate who went out and said, I'm for a dollar gas tax, I'm for, you know, I'm going to do this on Social Security, I mean, I don't think they would do particularly well. And then the question is, and then here's the hard part, if people see that person try to do something courageous and it fails and it hurts them politically, it tends to set it back. I mean, it's, you know, 13, 14 years now before we're getting back to universal health care. So I think a lot of things are possible, but they're really about, I think it was Dick Darman who made the phrase, how you figure out how people can hold hands and jump together. And I think to do difficult things, our leaders have to be better at kind of reaching out to the other side and creating that political cover. I'll give you three examples where it was done. Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill in the 1983 Social Security bill. My God, the things they did. Raised the retirement age, cut benefits. Ronald Reagan supported the first tax ever on Social Security benefits. Ronald Reagan. I mean, but the point was that Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan were willing to get together and do things that literally made them each want to throw up. But they knew that that sacrifice was the only way to give the other side the win to get something done. 1990, older President Bush and Speaker Foley. 1997, significant Medicare savings that would have been impossible for either side to do. Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich. You couldn't have more nemesis than that. So what we have to find, I think, you know, my fantasy, not as in my own, in a political partisan way, but just is, you know, I'd love to see a moment where you could have like a McCain and a Hillary Clinton or something where they actually agree on some issues, I think, in their hearts on fiscal responsibility or cap and trade for climate change, where they kind of pledge whoever loses will actually work with the other on getting some of those things done. But when our people do things like make pledges, I will never cut a penny of Social Security benefits. There must be 150 members of the Republican House who pledge, I will never raise a penny of taxes. Those things take off the table the ability to bring people of good faith together and have that political cover so that when somebody comes out with something difficult, they can take that tough vote because they can say, Ronald Reagan and Speaker O'Neill are for it. How could anybody be against it?
Just make one comment and then go to the audience. And that, is one of the problems that you just pointed out, Gene, I think is particularly important, and that is during the campaign period, there are a number of people, in order to get the nomination of their party, who tend to paint themselves in the corner, box themselves in, so that they will be less able, or in fact unable, to make the kind of compromises that you rightfully suggest. The second is that it wasn't always thus. If you go back, I mean, 2 days after the 4th of July, there was a very interesting thing on the History Channel, and perhaps some of you saw it, about the revolution. And the founding fathers, they all locked their arms together and decided they're going to jump over the cliff by signing the Declaration of Independence. If the revolution had failed, they all would have been hanged. They all understood this. And the third point is that a lot of the early emphasis of American politicians was, as was put by the founding fathers, themselves and their posterity. The problem is no one today speaks for the next generation and the next. What these people do is focus on the current generation and their ability to do well in the polls or their ability to get votes in the next election. There's very little attention to the next generation and the next. And you can see why, because they're kicking the can down the road on oil, on Social Security, Medicare. These are problems that if not addressed now are going to be huge burdens, huge risks for the next generation. So somehow taking this rather chronic short-term approach that the United States political system tends to generate, and encouraging people to take longer-term points of view, even though there may be some short-term pain, it seems to me is an enormous challenge of this process.
Sure.
In business, there's a particular type of bad chief financial officer that you'd see sometimes. And that was someone who recognized problems and really thought he could kick the can down the road till comfortably past his retirement. And if you look at politicians, it's endemic. I mean, we have there's a 2-year time frame for people in the House, 6 years in the Senate, so on average, people in the House are 1 year away from the next election, people in the Senate 3 years away. And one of the things government really does not do very well at all, or barely tries, is to think about what Bob was talking about, these longer term issues until they become totally pressing. The political courage that Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill showed in '83, my recollection was that people were saying, we're not going to be able to send the Social Security checks out pretty soon. So the headlights were coming right at them. There was a very interesting session at the Aspen Institute a couple of years ago. Two politicians were on the podium, Joe Lieberman and John McCain, two politicians that I personally respect. A lot of people here will have their own views. Bob Woodward asked them a kind of a surprise question from the audience. He said, can you think of any instances of political courage that stand out in your mind? He didn't define political courage. I would define it as a politician doing something that seriously threatens his or her base regard for them, reelection prospects, position. The fascinating thing, here were these two, I think, outstanding Americans. It took them quite a while to start coming up with some answers. There weren't a lot of instances. Well, I would say, ironically, at least in my mind, ironically, recently you've seen several episodes of it, one by Lieberman. Whether you agree with him or disagree with him is not the issue, but his stance on the Iraq War was violently unpopular with parts of his party, and he paid a price. McCain, whether you agree with him or disagree with him, his stance on immigration, the Iraq War, electoral funding was violently unpopular with some parts of his party, and he's paying a price. Typically, it's with the more extreme wings of both parties. George W. Bush, whether you agree or disagree with his proposal, said Social Security is an issue we should deal with. He said, I'll touch the third rail. He didn't have a lot of takers joining him. So I think, to an enormous extent, the politicians, to me, they do what politicians do. And what they've been doing since, if you're a historian, they've probably been doing the same thing since the Greek city-states, since the Roman Republic. They kind of pay a lot of attention to where the crowd is moving so they can get ahead of it. The American public has, I think, trained our politicians that it doesn't pay very well to get out ahead and show leadership. I think what happens is what Gene said. You get a good editorial in the New York Times, and you've probably crippled your career. So there's something very endemic to it, and I think for the next president to deal with it, I don't think he can think that. I think he's going to have to concentrate on a limited number of issues and spend a lot of time trying to build a consensus or a wave of support so people will do your good metaphorical phrase, join hands. And something of that sort seems to be happening now in climate change.
Can we go to the audience? Any questions? Yes, please.
You mentioned there's a visceral feeling against it on the part of a lot of people. You mentioned Seattle.
Can you? Is there a microphone? Oh, there are people lined up? It's hard to see. Okay. Why don't we, can you line up at one of the microphones, please, and then we'll start. Is someone lined up there?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
This has been terrific, but I wanted to, it's early in the morning, so I might have missed this, but it seems to me that one of those pair of headlights coming down the road wasn't fully mentioned, which is taxes. We have a huge federal budget deficit that is not going in the right direction. And if I mark it out correctly, 2010 is a very important year for taxes for two reasons. One is most of the tax cuts go away, probably affect a lot of people in this audience. And the other is the alternative minimum tax is going to affect many more millions of people. So I was wondering, tax advice, how are we going to change the tax system, which I do think is an issue the president, whoever he or she is, will not be able to escape in the next 4 years.
Good point. Steve, do you want to start, and then Gene?
Yeah, let me say something about the tax system. Our tax system is an abomination. It's this massive, overly complex, filled with strange special interest loopholes. It keeps hosts and hosts of lobbyists and families alive and well and in second and third homes. So the next question is, should we fix it? I'm scared to death about the attempt to fix it in any dramatic tax reform way. I think it's very easy to talk about fixing it when you stay at 30,000 feet and you talk in terms of, you know, it's got to be simpler, it's got to be fair, it's got to be equitable, you pick your phrase, it's got to be pro-growth. What happens if you try to do full-scale reform is those lobbyists. We did full-scale tax reform once in this century, in the mid to late 80s, and it was this rare situation where the moon and the stars and the planets were aligned, and we had bipartisanship, and they did it. And everyone knows that the basis of any effective tax reform is you have to make the tax base much, much wider by doing away with a lot of tax deductions, and then you can lower marginal rates, which pretty much every economist knows is very important for growth and incentives. That part is simple. What happens is when you say, let's make it wider, and Bob Hormat says, well, that means, of course, that the mortgage deduction has to go. Well, there's horror. And if someone over there says, well, that means the charitable deduction has to go, well, you're going to get attacked from that side. And then the lobbyists start coming out with the fact that the Republic can't stand if this particular deduction goes or that deduction goes. So it is a very there is a grave risk that if you try to do something full scale, you will wind up in a worse situation than we have now. Now, I personally, first of all, I'd say I don't agree with your premise that the budget's going the wrong way, deficit. You have to define the budget deficit. If you're talking about our as-it-goes kind of budget deficit, that's actually been going in a relatively good way. If you talk about down the road, what happens when Medicare starts kicking in and other things, it's horrendous and it's unsustainable. My own personal view is I haven't seen anything from Congress people indicating a willingness to cut spending. My concern is you start doing things which are tax raises, which have a real negative impact on the economy, and I don't see any accompanying will on the part of Congress to stop their spending. I personally think that we have to deal with the problem to a tremendous extent by addressing overspending, the earmarks, just the pork culture, and that would be my approach to it.
Well, I guess I gotta harp back to one thing that Stephen said at the beginning, which is the Hippocratic Oath. And I have to say that while I support it very much the notion that we needed tax cuts to stimulate the economy during and right after the recession and 9/11, and that even some middle-class tax relief was necessary, I believe that what's happened in the last year has been a complete violation of the Hippocratic Oath in terms of fiscal policy. There's no question that things have been made extremely worse. You had a period in the 90s where both sides were living roughly, not perfectly, but roughly with some notion of pay as you go. People asked, how did you pay for it? The continuation of tax cuts and the prescription drugs were passed without any offsets. They will probably cost us $300 to $400 billion a year in perpetuity. Now, as you're entering the period where you're about to hit the baby boom generation, the goal for this period was never just to be an average year. The goal was to actually be in surplus, is to actually be increasing your net national savings. So I can't agree with Stephen that things are just okay. I think it depends on your baseline. Things are about $800 billion worse per year than projected just 6 or 7 years ago. So I don't think that's a particularly satisfactory situation. The AMT is another example of where things were made worse. The cost of fixing the AMT is twice as, the alternative minimum tax, is twice as large as it would have been in 2001. The fact was that a whole new round of tax cuts were passed before Stephen's time. But it wasn't just they were passed. They were passed without accounting for what the cost would be of actually delivering them, of actually not allowing the alternative minimum tax to hit them. Now, we are where we are, and I think that with the kind of wage growth we've had among the middle class, it's going to be very difficult for anybody in the political system to not be for extending the middle class tax cuts. So I think that, you know, the right thing is in 2010 to let the tax cuts for the most well-off expire. Now, it still means people who make a few hundred thousand or more a year will get a tax cut. They'll just get kind of the same tax. They'll still get the tax cut on the lower rates. They just won't get the tax cuts that the new ones were added in. If you put things back to where things were in the 90s, there's no evidence that that led to poor economic policy. How much does that free up? It frees up over $100 billion a year. That's not going to solve all of our issues. But I think that, you will see a real choice. I think you will see people presenting that that could be enough to go a long way to getting universal health care in our country. And maybe the $100 billion that's offered for incentives on subsidies and universal health care can come with a little dose of pain in helping to bring down health care costs. So that's what I would recommend. And also just going back to our globalization issues, I agree that when you try to go into the market and try to affect all the inequality issues, you do have to go carefully. You could risk doing more harm than good. But that's what's beautiful about a progressive taxation system, is that you don't try to say, yes, Oprah deserves her money because she's really great and somebody else doesn't because they got lucky. You kind of say that if you're doing well and benefiting, that you're giving some back. Now, the most eloquent spokesperson for progressive taxation in our country, the single most, is sitting right there, Bill Gates Sr. So you should have him speak on this issue someday. But I do think in globalization, we are having more winner-take-all outcomes, and people are falling deeper, loser-lose-alls. A progressive tax system that says that those who are doing well recycle some of their gains to giving other people second or third chances would be the right thing to do. Let me just mention two things I think are doable. Our corporate tax system is kind of absurd in the sense we have the highest rates and yet we collect the least. We could reform that in a more rational way, less double taxation but more single taxation, and put more incentives for job creation here. I could imagine a bipartisan team coming together to do that. And secondly, and this is a critique of both sides of the aisle, one side of the aisle continues to focus on giving increased savings incentives for people who don't need them. And the other side just makes fun and says, oh, the ownership society, and it doesn't mean anything. We need a progressive savings agenda that helps the typical American save more. Right now, our system's upside down. If you're CEO, you get 35% savings. You save a dollar, you get a 35% deduction. Person who comes in to clean your office gets a 10% deduction. Explain that to me. Why do you give a 3 times greater incentive? And not only that, it's a candy land out there. There are so many different accounts, if you have money, that you can use to get greater savings. We have a completely upside-down system. We need to turn it right side up and give the greatest savings incentives to people who aren't saving, the lower-income and moderate Americans, maybe with a universal 401k with matching funds for everyone. That would deal with, we've talked about income inequality, that would help deal with wealth inequality. It would lead to greater savers, a greater savings society. It would give people a greater cushion, and it would increase our net national savings rate, which would help us on our larger macroeconomic issues, including the current account deficit.
Is there a question on this side, please? Yes.
Is this thing on? All right. If nobody else, I will speak for the next generation. Correct me if I'm wrong. This may be a very naive and cynical view on things. I tend to be like that. But those with influence are those with power. those with power, I've noticed, not exclusively, of course, tend to be those with money. Present company excluded, there seems to be a general mindset surrounding bringing up the middle and potentially lower class, and that is that if there is more wealth, benefits, what have you, for them, there is less for me. Not just in politics, where you have great leaders like Ronald Reagan who bit the bullet and, you know, made policy that may have been unfavorable, but in the long run worked.
Could you ask your question,
yes,
please?
Yes. How do you propose to combat that sort of mentality, that mindset within people of higher class, higher, you know, whatever?
Well, the first thing I want to say is there's a lot of wealth inequality on this panel.
Oh,
and
yes,
I'm on the way lower end. No, I just want to say, I think a couple of things I have tried to mention, I think are places you bring those together. When I'm talking about reaching out to the lowest, most disadvantaged young minority, African Americans, Hispanics, fifth, sixth grade, I'm saying that's the right thing to do. That's the right thing to do morally, value-wise. But I'm also saying that that will actually increase our economic growth. I just mentioned giving greater savings incentives for people lower middle income. That will help people have more wealth, greater home ownership, be able to take more advantage of the benefits of accumulated interest, wealth returns. But it would also be good for our country, too. And I also think, you know, you shouldn't shortchange. If you look at the different things happening on the internet, the different movements, I think there's been a lot more democratization of influence going on, you know, right in front of our eyes.
No.
No comments? Well, I think our time is up. I want to thank the panel, Steve and Gene, and thank all of you for coming.